Creativity is, by definition, creating something out of nothing.
If you're an artist, you learn that the thing that you think you're creating is not the thing that you end up creating.
The idea of failure in some ways is saying, I had an idea of what I thought needed to happen or what should happen, and it turned out differently. It's actually not failure at all.
This is what art does. Art gets to the soul, gets to the place where values, where relationships, where meaning is made. It's change, evolve, grow, stretch.
How we feel about our creative journey very often goes through these pendulum swings between feeling empowered and enlivened on one side and the feeling of inadequacy and the imposter syndrome on the other. The hero's journey, as the creative's journey, have these archetypal steps that play out in virtually every book, movie, or story you've ever heard. And they're the same ones that play out in our own lives. But they don't always come in a clear sequential order. Sometimes they're out of order. Sometimes they come all at the same time, and sometimes just interwoven in different ways. The refusal of the call is one of those archetypal steps.
So who wants to go first in terms of like refusal of the call and how you experienced that?
I think there was an initial leap of faith in hearing the call that to be an artist and what I was describing as sort of a clear path that began to emerge for me in my early 20s, which was contrasted really with the path of early fame and recognition that might well result in early burnout, because I saw that among my heroes, the people I admire, Damien Hirst, these young British artists, the Basquiats of the world, right? The Perry Farrells and, you know, the rock stars. It's like, wow, I could do that. But then what occurred to me is like, well, is it, you know, what about the later decades? Do I want to be a 50-year-old burnout, or what's my alternative? So seeing others who pace themselves differently, who constructed their lives differently to have artistic maturity in 40, 50, 60, 70, I was like, yeah, that's it. So there was this leap of faith that, okay, I can do this if I take this path. And what's needed? And I kind of began to assemble my materials and get my backpack. I did some traveling. When I finally kind of had this really clear, pivotal experience around meeting the work of Joseph Beuys, coming into contact with Rudolf Steiner, meeting Miha Pogacnik the Slovenian ambassador of culture, working with him, the path was pretty clear to me. It was like, okay, not only art, but art and social change, culture change, working with leaders, working with government, working with private sector leaders. And all of this was sort of laid out, dumped in my lap. Here's people already doing this work. Welcome to the tribe. Join the party. Join the team. So I actually spent a few years in Slovenia and in Europe working with Miha and this organization called IdriArt. And at the same time, it kind of dawned on me that my longer arc, growing through 30, 40, 50, 60 years, would be to take up that work. I was both excited about that and daunted. Daunting came from, well, I'm just a little Texas boy. How am I gonna learn what I really need to learn? And how am I gonna become like the people doing this? And that was part of that. And the other part of that for me was, well, I kind of want to be that rock star artist. And I don't want to be someone on the margins, someone working for the good work, but underpaid and underrecognized. And that was a conflict in me for about a decade, you know, especially as we met Louisa and had kids and started down that path. I would say that my initial refusal of the call had two sides. One was, who am I to do this? How could I possibly join this legacy of people like Joseph Beuys? And the second one was, when do I get some little bit of fame and recognition so I can like, so this whole thing is worth it? Mm. That kind of set up in me this pendulum swing between the fantasy and the longing for recognition, the grandiosity, that the great me, like, I'm going to do this great thing in the world. It's going to be awesome because I'm awesome and I have all this talent and energy and I'm going to like go do this. Alternating at the other side of the pendulum with, real self-doubt and even self-loathing, and I'm crap, I'm no good, I can't do this. That continued for years. That was a big part of the underlying struggle of the next decade for me.
This oscillation.
Yeah.
Between grandiosity and self-loathing.
Yeah, and realizing over time that this was a problem. You know, and at first, for the first few years, I would say, you know, on the one hand, I was accomplishing things. I was doing this work overseas. I was meeting all these great people. I was having fun. Like, the path was clear. This is your path. You are now a Jedi, and or you're a wizard, Harry. And okay, so I'm doing this work. I am picking up the legacy of Joseph Beuys and Miha and others. And I was studying that work, and I did have a mentor. I met my mentor, Dennis Klocek, during those years. Seeing him just completely opened my eyes to what kind of person I could become. And at the same time, here was a person who wasn't recognized in the world. He wasn't appreciated for his genius as much as he should be. And that kind of woke me up. I was like, wow, here's a person who's really mastered himself, really has really developed his gifts, is the kind of soul that I want to become. And nobody knows about him. He is... I mean, few people know about him, right, in that world where he dwells, but he's not famous, he's not wealthy, he's not on TV, he's not in the art museums, and he's perfectly content being who he is. So I had that in front of me. I had my mentor, I had my Obi-Wan as my example, and it took me, I don't know, until, it just took me many, many years to figure out that I was unhelpfully swinging between these two extremes. Mm. I was seeing myself as someone important on one day and someone who was not important, a real loser on the next day. And so that was part and parcel of that phase of my life, of like, I'm called, but I'm not worthy, the refusal of the call. Mm-hmm. And the meeting of the mentor who was everything that I wanted to be and made me realize if I'm going to become like that, I might end up giving up other things that are really important to me, like worldly recognition, fame, wealth, and so forth.
And you weren't quite prepared to do that.
No. I mean, I wanted to be.
You wanted to want it?
I wanted to mature to the point where I could stop wanting certain things that I really did want.
Mm.
But that took a long time.
Yeah.
It's interesting sitting here hearing you talk about that. Because one thing is I started thinking about this sort of phase in life, right? This what am I going to do? Setting out, finding a mentor. You know, the refusal to finding the mentor. Actually getting the courage to go and do it. That's a really, at least for me, and then hearing for you too, is actually a really long time. And it's funny, I mentioned this yesterday, that, wait a second, when we read about this in the book, that section, or you watch Star Wars, that's 5 minutes or 10 minutes, right? That's the beginning of it. You read Parsifal, and it's like, okay, we got to get to the meat of the story. So we have to set up the life, right? And then there's the call to action, or the call to adventure, the refusal, the finding the mentor, the accepting of it and going for it. And we got to get on with our story. So now we're going to wrap that up really quickly. But in life, that's a decade.
I mean, the stormtroopers burned Luke's house down. So he was like, okay, I guess I'll go with Obi-Wan. Mm-hmm. And Harry, of course, was like, either stay with the Dursleys or go with Hagrid.
It was kind of easy.
and I had a bit the same. I could continue to downward spiral with drugs or whatever, or I could get on a path. You know, I could continue to exercise the fantasy of being a great artist among thousands of other young men and women who were exercising that, who were following that fantasy, or I could get on a path. But the path meant moving to California, studying with Dennis, learning about anthroposophy. It meant actually studying the depth of what Beuys was trying to do, and not just having the glamour and the glitter.
So you're saying that was, you're not saying that was easy.
I'm not saying that was easy. Okay, on the one hand, it was a moment in my life. I did have a metaphorical house burning down. My house didn't burn down, but there was nothing for me to stay in Texas keep living with my mom and try to follow an art career. That just wasn't interesting. And it was empty. And I didn't have any friends and my relationships kind of disintegrated. So I did reach a kind of pre-midlife crisis in my early 20s when everything just melted away. All of my, everything that I considered me and important and who I am just ruptured. And I like lived in my mom's attic for 6 months trying to put my soul back together. And just before that happened, I met the work of Joseph Beuys, found the work of Rudolf Steiner, and then I met Denis Klocek, all within the same 6 months. So while my world was totally falling apart, I was also meeting my mentor.
So that's, so the refusal of the, so these are two archetypal phases in the hero's journey. You know, we've already talked about the call to adventure, but then comes the refusal of the call, and then next is the meeting of the mentor. So you, so you're really describing that this is really sure what happened in your life.
Yeah. I'm not sure they all happened in that same order because there was a bit of a refusal and then the meeting of the mentor and then more refusal and then more call, you know, and then more refusal.
Yeah. But it was like a cycle?
Yeah. This was the phase of trying to find my path, suffering a lot, but having a really clear path and alternating between, well, this is such a fantastic path. How could it possibly be for me? It's too good to be true. I'm not good enough. I'm unworthy. And I'm really excited about this. Isn't it going to be great? I'm going to conquer the world. I'm going to be awesome. That's the grandiosity piece. So these kind of three things, the grandiosity, the road ahead, and the self-loathing, were all interwoven for me during those years.
Sure. Now tell me about how long you sort of the beginning of those years were and where you, that sort of phase ended. Maybe it never ended.
Well, I mean, sure.
I mean, this is life, not a story.
You know, it's not a script. We had kids, and I think that next phase of the hero's journey, which we'll get to, about the meeting of allies, tests, enemies, allies. I had a lot of tests, a lot of tests. And I would think that, that for me, the tests very clearly culminated in the supreme ordeal of my midlife phase.
But I'm really curious, like, because you were talking about this section, even when you say there were these 6 months where I was living in my mother's attic.
Yeah.
And I want to kind of get a picture of the time frame of this first, of this little section you were just describing between the crumbling, the, the grandiosity, et cetera, the living in mom's attic. And part of what's interesting to me, and I think will be interesting to our listeners, is 6 months, depending on where you are in your life, feels can feel like a really long time. And you just threw it away. You said, oh, it's been 6 months, right?
Yeah.
And
no, that, it wasn't like that. It was, I mean, that kind of absolute meltdown, breakdown, crying all the time, feeling like I was just eviscerated inwardly. What then opened in me after that was a clarity about a desire to heed this call and follow that path. So the, for me, the call came with the destruction of everything. It was a kind of Luke Skywalker burning down the house moment, but not physically, but spiritually, inwardly, emotionally. My parents were there for me. I had good friends and some, you know, some, but the thing that I thought I was doing was just, I don't know, everything crumbled. And so that was an intensive moment. Now, when I moved to California and began to study with Denis, then I moved to Slovenia, worked with Idriart, met you. Those were years of high adventure. And that was me finding my way. And in those years, I was still pendulum swinging in those years. And I didn't know about this pendulum. It took me a long time to kind of realize, oh, you know, half the time I'm really high and half the time I'm really low. But where's the middle? And that took better part of 10 years.
Right. So that was kind of what I was just getting at, right? Is that, that this, that this is 10 years of going through this, which is a blip in the stories we read. And ultimately, I think for most of us, we think it should be like the beginning of the story. Let's, we got to get through that part so we can get on our real adventure and get to our task. Kind of forgetting a bit that actually that decade was completely integral to being a hero, right?
Yeah. So for me, the test enemies, allies, like following this mentor, going on that path, I had 20 years of tests, enemies, and allies, and like really being tested, really finding my allies, working with them, finding people that I didn't want to work with, ways that I didn't want to be in the world, facing myself, that wonderful moment in Star Wars where Luke, in Empire Strikes Back, where Luke takes off the mask of Darth Vader and sees himself, like just harrowing, but also adventurous years of finding the way. That was definitely a part of my path.
Yeah, and the oscillation became less extreme and became gradually smaller as an oscillation, as the egoity burned out of you and your soul became stronger. Of course, I'm your wife, so I have a little bit of an inside track.
Yeah.
And, you know, I watched this. It's a tough love for the egoity to be burned out of us. There's just no way around it. It's just hard to, but it's so important, because when you really meet your life mission, you know, that pre-birth intention or the reason why you're here, you have an inkling about you're here for a reason, and then your life becomes this hunt for that reason. Yeah. And I'm afraid that one of the things that block you from ever discovering what that is egoity.
Yeah, and the other one is fear.
Yes.
And so the self-hatred and the self-loathing, or that pull of clamping up and rigidifying, is related to fear.
Mm.
And so over the years, we worked really hard together, separately, as a couple, as a community, to check these two extreme poles.
Yeah.
You know, is this fantasy? Is this fear? Where is the middle path? Because the call was clear. This is the path. But the transformations that we have to endure, they have to be endured. They have to be lived in order to actually be transformative.
Yeah.
But I kind of want to just touch on that a little bit too, because the pendulum may not swing as hard as it has before, but it's fascinating for me to hear you talk about that and say from the outside, and just coming, meeting you, seeing you briefly as you've been in the middle of a struggle or a doubt, because in our last couple of our last conversations, really before the Zimbabwe thing came along, was you even said, "I'll do anything," right? Like I just got to do something. So there was actually the pendulum is still swinging. And hearing you say this now in this context, having had these meetings over the year, is, man, I feel like when I articulate what's going on for me, I actually feel the same way. My pendulum doesn't swing like it used to. I don't necessarily go to the deep lows. I don't have the deep highs, the high highs. I feel like that pendulum is still there, and some of the questions are still there. And I think that that's kind of important to highlight that, because particularly when the pendulum is back on the upswing, or we've taken that moment out, because we actually have the capacity to not let the lows destroy us anymore or really crush us like they once did. They still come. And I think that's in some ways comforting to ourselves to just acknowledge that, and comforting for others to know that, hey, it doesn't matter who you are or where you are in your life, we go through these pendulum swings.
For me, when I look back at the last, say, 45, so 25 years, there was the youthful days of thinking I could be great, and I had this, you know, riding the lightning, I'm going to do this. And along the way, getting to know like, oh, okay, there's these other tendencies and habits in myself that I have to overcome. I have to work on myself, because I actually am getting my ass kicked in the world, and I'm not as good a husband or a father as I want to be. I'm not as good an artist as I need to be. So there was a reckoning of looking at myself and realizing I have to self-transform. And when I look at the hero's journey, this test, enemy, allies, is like truing of the true self. It's like you're in the forge. You are being winnowed. You're being challenged. You're testing yourself. And all of that leads to supreme ordeal, which definitely happened in my life. And so just coming out of that now. So the pendulum doesn't swing as much, but what has happened in the last, say, 5 years is that the heat is turned up. It's like I'm being asked, do you really want to do this work? And if so, you have to really step into self-transformation. Like we've shown you a bit of the things that you need to work on, and now you have to grow out of them. So there has been like, so for me, that pendulum swing, I don't know, like you could imagine the whole thing just catching fire and burning out a lot of the reasons this is swinging so much. A lot, the egoity, the fear, they are still there, but in my life, the heat turned up so much that something else was born. Like, oh, this willingness to show up and be the best Matthew Temple you can be, that's a maturation. And that maturation occurs slowly and through pain and through suffering and through work. And that, I think, is part of the inner core that the artists have. The artists who can endure decade after decade after decade after decade and get to their best work in their later years because they're mature. They've wisened up. They've grown that wisdom. They've grown that solid inner core somehow. And I think that's the fruit of this process in my own way of thinking right now.
I think turning the heat up, so two pictures side by side, turning the heat up and the oscillation, there's a third picture to kind of put in there, and that is if you refuse the call and then you keep refusing the call, because what is the call? The call is your life mission, why you're here, let's just say that. If you refuse that call, there's all this untapped creative energy that is in you, that potential, that you do not realize, you do not bring out. And what happens to that energy is that it turns on you. It's there, and it could have been good if you had not refused the call.
Yeah.
But so long as you do, it becomes a thing that is unhealthy.
So how have you experienced that in your life?
So I've experienced a lot of refusal of the call, if we could say. So when I was 21 or 22, I don't even remember, it was so long ago, I got this major tendonitis injury, which stopped my career as a violinist from one day to the next. And so it was enough of an injury that I couldn't play anymore. I mean, I did keep playing because I had lots of commitments and I had all these performances that I had to do, which I did. And by the end of the 3 months that I had, I'd just really done a number on my elbow. I still have the injury today, 25 years later. That's not anything like as bad, of course, but back then I couldn't even, I'm a lefty. I couldn't write, I couldn't open doors. I could not use this left arm at all. I had to learn. I'm now ambidextrous because I had to learn to use my right hand. That's how bad it got. So that was the end of my music career. Now you have to understand, my parents are professional musicians. I grew up performing, going to concerts. My whole life was classical music. That's all I knew. That's all I ever did. So it was a point of like, this you cannot do anymore. And I was like, I absolutely refuse to heed that thing. I'm going to go to Europe and I'm going to study singing instead. So I went to Europe and I studied singing for 2 years, and it was agony. It was total agony because I couldn't sing. So as a violinist, the violin was a natural fit for my personality, you know, highly strung, as you know, hard on my sleeve. It's like, I'm a total violinist, right? And it was I was a natural. But singing, I totally didn't understand it. I didn't get it. I had a very instrumentalist mindset, and you cannot sing with that kind of analytical detached, because your body and your emotions and your soul is your instrument. Mm. And all you can do as a singer is set up the conditions. It's a peripheral kind of...
But all this you've learned since then.
I have.
Yeah.
But at the time, I totally didn't get it. So and by the end of 2 years, yeah, I lost my voice. I could not even sing.
And was that another call?
It was another like...
Wake up?
Yeah, it was another like... It was a call. I didn't know what the heck it was really about. It was just like, you can't do this, dude. Right. Like, we've already told you.
Yeah.
You, and then you have to go, like, try, you know, keep pursuing it.
Right.
Sorry, but this is not your thing.
This is not your path.
And, but I kept trying, right? So, for the next, I don't know, 10 to 15 years, I would revisit singing. And I could not let go of the desire for recognition, for the narcissism of music. I couldn't let it go. So even while I had babies, and even though there were, I was starting to build the thing, the path, the narrow way that was really my destiny, I could not let go of it. So if I had, I think I could have gotten somewhere a lot quicker than I did, somewhere more, you know, where I am now. Like, looking back, it's like, oh my God, why did you take so long?
Because you were refusing the call.
I was refusing the call.
But there was more.
And it was, but it was agony, because I had to go through this desert.
Well, so for you, there was not only the call not to be a professional musician in the standard normal sense.
Yeah.
There was also a positive call, a call to do something else, which was when you got involved with me at IdreArt.
Yeah.
You did the course in California with Dennis. So what was this path for you?
Yeah, so it was like the dying world and the being born world. So the dying world was me continuing to be in fantasy. Now the fantasy was being an opera singer. I mean, it's so silly now, because I don't actually like opera. I don't like it. I find it like, oh my God. Anyway, but I still held on to this fantasy of being an opera singer. Okay. So then I met you in the middle of this crisis of losing my voice. How old were you then? 24 was when I met you. So at the beginning of my time in Europe, and you were there the whole time when I was going through that. I was so unhappy. Do you remember? I mean, you were like a linchpin for me. You were my rock of Gibraltar through this really tough time. But at the same time I met you, I met IdreArt, which is the Institute for the Development of Intercultural Relations Through the Arts.
Mm-hmm.
Miha Pukacnik. I met Miha Pukacnik at the same time. For the first time in my life, now remember, I'd grown up around musicians, I came across this concept that the arts could be a healing force in the world. Never had come across that before. So that was deeply inspiring to me. It was like the beginning of a new thing. Mm.
But ironic that Miha is also a violinist.
Yeah, I know. But of course, the pull to egoism was much stronger than this new seed. However, it was there, and it was enough, because it would bear fruit much, much later on, once I got over my fantasy and my refusing of the call. And then, so he was a mentor in that experience, and there were the people around him, like Trudy Rubing, who was just this wonderful woman that Jeff and I, we both worked with in Holland. And then there was Dennis.
Yeah.
So I heard about the Consciousness Studies program, or the we knew it as the Goethean Studies program, but because all three of us have done it, right? I heard about it from you because you'd done it, and I was like, okay, this is the last thing that I will try, because I've tried everything else. Nothing has worked in my life. I don't know where to go now, because if I'm not a musician, I don't know what I am, and I have no sense of what I could be if I'm not a musician. So I went to California and I did consciousness studies, and it is now the foundation upon which I stand. This was such a classic meeting the mentor and giving me, does the mentor give you a gift? I can't remember, does that come later? Lots of tools with
legacy,
context. And without those tools, honestly, I don't know if I would have been able to find a way to let go of the fantasy and to forge a new identity, a new way forward. It's like he gave me a path to follow. He couldn't do it for me. He was just showing me the door, but he could give me the tools and the exercises and the concepts and the way forward. That was my experience of the refusal of the call, and then meeting the mentor.
It's interesting, as we were talking yesterday, sort of, you know, we talked about call to adventure was not necessarily what I thought it was in my late teens.
Yeah, but there was a moment in your biography when it became clear to you that you weren't going to be an actor. You were going to be a producer.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that is a call and a refusal of a call. I mean, did you resent that? Did you refuse that call?
Perhaps in some ways I did.
I wondered about it at the time. Because I knew you wanted to be an actor and it wasn't working.
Yeah.
And you became a producer and it was like, well, that's really cool, but how do you feel about that?
And I always said I would drop it all just to be an actor. Mm. Would have been my answer.
There you go.
Mm.
And that never came around.
Right.
And which is interesting because I've found a way, I mean, as a producer and a director and a writer, which is really how I make my living now, that in some ways the one thing that really kept me from fully being able to engage as a performer was recognizing the egoism in being, in wanting to do that as a profession, right? Because then that's just, it's me. Right? This is me on, say, I am the face of whatever it is.
So are you saying that you, sorry, I missed that because I think I misheard it. But are you saying the thing that kept you from being the best writer, director, producer you could be was still the longing to be an actor? Is that what you said?
Okay. Yeah. And I didn't really recognize that, you know, when I made my first feature film, the reason why I didn't direct it, that I wrote and I went out and I raised over $100,000 and got other foundation support as well. And
the one that you acted in.
No, I ended didn't
up,
act
in. I ended up not acting in it.
Yeah.
Did I see that one?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the one
Senses
that we saw.
Senses of Place.
Yeah, Senses of Place. I thought you were in that.
No, I wrote it for myself.
Oh, you wrote it for yourself.
And the only reason why I wrote that screenplay was that I had realized that I, as a father of three, while working nights and taking a, you know, and taking 18 credits in college.
Right.
There was no time to do theater. Right. And theater rehearsals were at night when I had to be waiting tables so I could pay the bills. So that was why I thought, you know, I'll sign up and take a screenwriting 101 class. And that short film became a feature film that we ended up raising a bunch of money for and, you know, went out on the festival circuit.
Well, what I remember is that you discovered that you couldn't produce it as well as direct it, as well as write it, and you act in it, and you were forced to find another director and to let go of acting in it because all you could do is produce it, given all your other commitments.
And
I wonder if that was part of the call and the refusal of the call.
It could very well. I think that there was, is that ultimately my call was not to be an actor.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
My call was to do something else.
So,
but I wanted that in the same way that you held on to wanting to be a musician.
Yeah. Okay, but
that was part of the call that got you going.
Yeah. Because on one hand, you can't say that the call was the thing that you didn't do.
Right.
The call was something that you did. So
yes.
Would you just give us a little sense of, like, we get a picture of the refusal of the call, but what was the call?
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
Right. Ultimately, it was, you know, if I look at my career, I'm a storyteller. That's what I do. I tell stories for a living. And I think ultimately that's really what was coming along, right? Here I am 22 years old, 23, something like that. And I've written a script, or maybe 24, right? But in my early 20s, I wrote a screenplay. Mm. Somehow I was able to raise this money to make this movie. And as I said, I didn't direct it because I was going to act in it. Mm. And I ended up not acting. Yeah, it was going to be too much, but also quite frankly, I didn't understand who I was as a 23 or 24 year old with three children. I had traveled the world and I spoke several languages. I felt like I was a very old and mature person. So I wrote a screenplay for a character that was supposed to be that had kids, et cetera. And nobody who looked my age has children. I looked really young.
Yeah, I bet you so did.
People keep telling me
you shave that beard and you go back to looking about 25.
That's why I keep it.
Yeah.
I need some respect around here. So there was very much this I wrote a screenplay and then I made a movie and I came to LA having really acted in nothing of substance, but having written and produced a feature film that had that did fairly well in the festival circuit.
Right.
You know, it's you can go and watch it on Amazon. Right. But I resisted that for a very long time.
Mm.
And it wasn't actually even until I had come through in the financial crisis. I had no way to make a living. I went back to tending bar and waiting tables because there was just no work in LA. And it was actually at that moment, so I'm older than all of you when it really kind of hit me. Mm. So it was about 31 maybe, 31, 32, when my sort of acceptance finally came around.
Mm-hmm.
And that acceptance was, I'm a creator, I'm an artist, and I have to be creating something at all times. So my rule to myself was I'm leaving LA or I am making something, whether I'm paying for it, I'm being paid for it, or I'm doing it for free. It doesn't matter. I'm always creating. Mm-hmm. And that in some ways would have been that moment. And all of that time before was in many ways just refusing it,
mm-hmm.
that particular call.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and like you guys, too, I mean, I founded Network M, which became We Strive.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was busy doing, doing pieces that, engaging. But I feel actually even now as I'm getting to where, now I can look back and I can see, there's a certain foundation that you have to lay in order to build upon that. And for you, even as an artist, right, or you as an artist, the foundation might actually be Magenta and Worldmaker, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you build the art on top of that. Whereas mm-hmm. for me, it might be a filmmaker and then building Worldmaker and We Strive or some mm-hmm. other stuff on top of that. What is that foundation?
Mm-hmm.
So that would really have been, this all this time is this, and it was so much of, there really was so much egoism wrapped up in it with to be an actor that I need to be out there for people to praise, creating Network M and We Strive. Even the idea of why I wanted to be a change maker in the world in a certain sense was I want to make a difference. It's important that I
mm-hmm.
make a difference.
And you get recognition for that.
Right.